Welcome to the last day of TechEd. First session in the day. It's tough to crack that nut in the morning. And I really appreciate you guys are here. Either you know me and you want to support me, I see a few familiar faces, or you really want to know something about RBAC. Either way, welcome. I usually start with the question before my introduction. How many of you are here because you work with RBAC and you have questions, or you just want to know about RBAC? Two different questions, so let's start with one, right? You have RBAC, you have deployed RBAC, you're maybe struggling with it, have questions? Okay, great. You haven't touched RBAC in a sense that RBAC's out of the box configured and you haven't configured it in any custom way and you just want to know how to do that. Okay, great. Great. So myself, Bhargav Shukla, I work for Kemp Technologies. As a trade, I started in IT about 17 years ago. Started working with Exchange, well, before Exchange actually, with MS Mail and then Exchange 4, and from there on to all the different iterations. Around Exchange 2010 timeframe, I did my certified master's in Exchange, went on just before the MCM program was killed off, did my 2013 upgrade, and currently I'm an Exchange MVP, just to give you a little bit of background of where I come from. What we want to talk about today is RBAC coming from what it was before, what it is now in different products within Microsoft, and how it's used. Specifically, we would dive more into Exchange and a little bit of link towards the end as well, how it works and how it is different from Exchange. And we'll also talk about the deployment planning, which in my mind actually should be first on top. Start with planning before your deployment, figure out what you really need in terms of permissions. We'll talk about that. So as we start with RBAC, it goes far back in the history of time, actually, and looking at the way the computers are going, 2003 is way far in distance in the past, right? The concept of role-based access control is not new. If you had some custom applications, if you worked with SQL guys and you had some applications that were using SQL database, you would have noticed there are many different ways of controlling how you get into that application, if it's web-based application or a Windows-based application developed in C, whatever. Especially in the 2000-2003 days, I'm talking Windows times, you had applications. I actually worked with applications that had their own control. So they didn't necessarily rely on Active Directory for authentication. They had their own authentication. And what they did after that authentication piece is decide, based on your logon, what permissions you had and what you could and you could not do in the applications. How many of you remember the authorization manager from 2003 timeframe? Okay, great. It's a rare animal that very few have heard of, but it existed, and what it was doing is it was giving you that abstraction layer from Active Directory. Because in Active Directory, what it is it's a repository of security objects, your users, your groups. It doesn't necessarily know the application that's going to use Active Directory for authentication and then decide what user has permissions to. AD only has that repository, right? When it comes to application has to then have its own logic to figure out what is presented to the user. Granular control then becomes an issue, which was evident in Exchange 2000, 2003, 2007. How many of you had admin role where you had a consultant coming on board for a few months to help you with your project of deploying or upgrading to the newer version of Exchange, and you wanted to give them read-only permissions. Anyone? A couple of them. Which version? 2003? 2007? Just raise your hand if it was 2003. 2007? Okay, and how easy was it to give the read-only permissions? I'll take a swipe. How easy is it today to give someone exactly the permissions of read-only or whatever other permissions you are trying to give? So, in 2003-2007 time frame, if you wanted to give someone read-only, you had one of those delegation wizard you go to and select the read-only permissions, and you thought you had read-only permissions. In 2003, if you had clustered mailbox servers, was it really the read-only permissions that they were able to use and access the cluster, were able to see everything? When you give them read-only, you thought it would be enough, but it wasn't. Right, you had to give them more permissions. Cluster was an OS object, not Exchange object, so Exchange delegation didn't give them access to the cluster object. For most part, I see people just assigning admin permissions because that's how on the OS you can see the cluster objects and deal with it. I mean, it wasn't the best model. It wasn't helping as much as you wanted it to. So the RBAC is basically bringing the concept of you have Active Directory, you have the DACLs, you have different permissions based on your group memberships, but that doesn't understand what application's trying to do and what you have to meet in terms of people's job roles, what each person logging into your system has to do and achieve. And that's where RBAC is trying to help. It comes in as that abstraction layer that allows you, based on the application that you're using, Exchange or Link for an example, to give you the granular permissions, ability to grant the granular access to the system, and also remove that burden from Active Directory guys, because if you try to assign any of the permissions that weren't in the delegation wizard, how did you achieve that in 2003 and 2007? Did anyone try? Any brave souls? That was ugly, right? You had to go to Active Directory, figure out your Exchange objects, where they are, which partition of Active Directory they are in, and then assign the permissions there. Now, if you did that, if you were brave enough to do that, then it was a nightmare for both management and auditing. When it comes to auditing, how do you audit that? Somebody had to document exactly what they did in Active Directory with ACLs and figure out when it's the audit time. You basically look at the document and try to match if that's still true in Active Directory. If it wasn't, where else would you look? You would have no idea because there are so many objects in there, right? With RBAC, for an example, in Exchange, now you as an Exchange admin or Exchange architect, you manage that from Exchange side. You don't go to AD guy and say, hey, let's figure out these ACLs on the Exchange objects and what we are going to assign. You don't have to do that anymore. When you install Exchange, you have certain permissions in Active Directory, and then you can, as the org admin or a member of org management group, you can then start assigning permissions to different groups for different levels. It removes dependency on AD, provides ability to granularly control the access. And as we know it for Exchange and Link, it came around in 2010. That's when it was introduced first, and from there on it just grew for 2013. So let's look at role-based access in Exchange 2013. It's relatively similar in 2010, not much different. What is different, I'll point out. But if you start with the basics, what do we have, right? Where do we start? When you look at Exchange, the first thing you would do after install is either you would go to the admin center or you would start the shell, right? If you're someone like me who just loves PowerShell and likes to do it that way, just open the Exchange management shell. So these are the two basic tools that we most commonly use. When you start it for the first time and make some changes, let's say the basic change of defining your URLs that you're going to use to access instead of using the default hostname. When you do that in Admin Center, what is it going to do in the backend? It's going to call those commandlets and then make that change for you, right? Where does it hook into? What does it use as the basic components for it to work, whether it's Admin Center or Management Shell? It's basically a PowerShell, right? When you look at Management Shell, it's PowerShell with Exchange specific components, definitions of the Exchange objects, what a mailbox means and what different properties of mailbox are. Because you manage Exchange not only from the server, how many of you actually log on to the server to do anything with Exchange right on the Exchange server? And how many of you manage it remotely from your workstation or from a management station, right? So either way, whether you're on the server itself or on a remote machine, what you're basically doing is you're making a remote call. Even on the server itself, if you have just single server in your entire org and you're connecting to that, you're still making a remote call to the system. The reason for that is you want to go through the framework of RBAC. You want to go through that RBAC framework so that Exchange provides you with the necessary permissions. If you were to figure out a way to bypass that, what's the point of having that system, right? If you can log on to server itself and log on to Management Shell and you don't have any of that layers that can actually authenticate you and verify your granular permissions provided through RBAC, there is no use. So what Exchange guys did is they made sure the way you connect is same whether you're local or remote. What you're doing is when you start the PowerShell, how many of you have actually looked at the properties of Management Shell and see what it actually does? Okay, what does it do? It calls a PSC file, right? And basically, if you open that PSC file, it's nothing but a PowerShell script, right? It's a PowerShell script that, like I said earlier, it calls and defines all those objects that are specific to Exchange. And then in the process, after defining all the definitions of the objects and setting the variables like $x scripts, when you type that, it takes you to the scripts folder of Exchange. After doing all that, the next thing it does is it connects to Exchange by calling Exchange hostname or the URLs that you have defined, / PowerShell. Right? So you're going basically to IIS, connecting to that PowerShell virtual directory, which then is tied into the RBAC framework, and it then does what it's supposed to do. Pulls up your user identity, pulls up your group memberships, looks at what permissions you have from Exchange perspective, and then presents you only the commandlets you have access to, only the parameters you have access to. So when you launch Management Shell and you see that bar running up top showing you it's loading the commandlets, that's what it's doing. It's figuring out what access you have and only presenting you the commandlets you have access to, not everything Exchange has. So if you're a help desk user, you won't have access to the commandlets like import, export mailboxes because that's not part of your role. If you type that commandlet, what happens? You just get an error. The commandlet's not there. And then you might say, well, actually, I'm looking at TechNet, and the commandlet is there in Exchange 2013, but I don't see it. That's the RBAC in action, right? So even local EMS goes through IIS, something to remember. There is one thing that I think is clear enough, but I like talking about because it might be clear enough for me, but not everyone. what it is in 2010, it was talked about your dependencies. So if I go back to previous slide, you see WinRM is one of the dependencies. You have to install PowerShell or the Windows management framework, which includes PowerShell, WinRM, and such. WinRM is what allows you to remotely connect to the server using PowerShell and manage remote servers, right? How many of you run WinRM, the enable PS remoting on your servers when you install servers, whether it's Exchange or regular Windows servers? A few of them. And why do you do that? Is that, if it was an Exchange server, is that because Exchange needs that, or is that for some other reason? Sorry? Other reason, okay. And that's what I want to hear. Basically, the WinRM requirement to create the listener is not the requirement for Exchange. You don't need to create a PowerShell listener, right? Like I said earlier, the way you are connecting to that remote PowerShell is not through the PowerShell framework. You are using the WinRM components, however. But you're connecting through the PowerShell virtual directory that Exchange surfaces on each of the Exchange servers. So you don't have that default PowerShell listener. It doesn't rely on that. Now, you could have the listener if you enable PS remoting for other reasons. For an example, if you want to use your PowerShell for managing the basic operating system functions on Exchange server. How do you connect remotely using PowerShell? That's two simple commandlets. The first one is you're creating a session where you're telling the server, create a session that I can connect to. And that's where you're calling the config name of Exchange, connection URI of server/PowerShell. And the next step is to import that session that server has created into your local PowerShell. When you do that, that's when you see that bar going up top, importing the commandlets you have access to, and so on. This is also where it can basically say, well, Mr. X, I don't see you having any permissions on Exchange, so I'm not going to give you anything, right? One of many possibilities. Now, if I go back to this slide, when you connect remotely to Exchange using this method, is it any different from using management shell? How many of you wrote script on Exchange server or tested using management shell and then tried to run using regular PowerShell and it did not work? Right? So that just tells you it's different. Why is it different? What is different? When you simply connect using these options, all you're doing is making a connection to the server, which is what Management Shell does, but Management Shell does all the other things that we discussed earlier, right? The definitions of Exchange objects. For an example, when you look at Exchange admin display version, you have, if it's Exchange 13, 2013, it is 15.0 or 15.1 dot major, minor, right? All those version number, major, minor, that's the definition that you have in Management Shell, defined by Management Shell and the libraries it's calling. When you simply connect using remote PowerShell, you're not providing any of that information to your PowerShell session. You don't have those XMLs. You're not loading those definitions in it. So when you call the same commandlet, get-exchange-server, give me the admin display version dot major or dot minor, it basically fails to give you that information. What looks like major and minor definitions of the version in management shell looks like a text string of the full version 15.0.xy in remote PowerShell because it doesn't have those definitions. Just something to think about. When you write the scripts, test it the way it's going to be run out there by whoever is going to run it. So when we look at the models coming from 2003 and 2007, you had different management groups. In 2003, it gave you three. So when you run the delegation wizard, you were able to define someone was a full admin, someone was an Exchange administrator. Funny enough, the two sound similar but not the same. And the third one was view only, kind of read only admin. 2007, you had 5 management groups, so you had some more. Thinking of 2010, they could have easily just expanded that from 5 to maybe 10, 15, right? But think about all the different things you can do with Exchange. And of course, with 2010, you had a lot of new things coming. You had database availability group, you had the client access server separated from mailbox and doing things differently. It would have been easier to define more management group, but it would have been better to provide something that was completely different and a departure from that. And that's why you see RBAC in 2010. What you see is this model. You have these different components where Exchange says, why don't we have some common set of permissions on Active Directory, and then we manage the rest from Exchange side, provide the permissions. So what you define is you define 4 different components, right? You have, first of all, what do you need to do? You need to create mailboxes. You need to provide someone access to a shared mailbox. You need to configure database settings, right? Those are the commandlets that you're going to run. Those are the parameters you're going to use with the commandlets that are there. The next one is, where are you going to perform those actions? So if you have a group of administrators who are responsible for North American population of your company, you have a group of administrators who are responsible for APAC or EMEA, right? You want to make sure that's where they can perform those actions. So you're giving them access to new mailbox commandlet, for an example. That doesn't mean they can run that everywhere in your org, right? For org admin, that's true, but for other roles, that may not be true. You may want to control how that works. So that's the scope. You see that further down here in the where section, right this here. Then you have users, whether it's administrators or users themselves. So if you talk about admins, that's what we said. You have these different admins. They want to perform different actions in different places, right? Their management scope. So those are these guys up here. And then you have users in Exchange 2010, 2013. As a user, if you logged on to OWA, you can go to options. And then you can set your options, such as out of office, your phone number, your other preferences. You could manage all that. Ultimately, what is it doing if you're doing it from there? It's basically calling some commandlets, right? Exchange has to know you have those permissions. So that's also managed by RBAC. That's also managed by RBAC framework. So if you dive into that first component of what you have access to, how you translate that to the RBAC speech is management roles and the role definitions, right? So the management roles are basically commandlets and parameters. When you look at any given management role, organization management delegation, mailbox management, all those management roles, that basically is a group of commandlets, parameters that allow you to do something. It basically defines a job role, right? How many of them, in contrast with 2003 and 2007, the 3 and 5, how many do you have predefined in Exchange? With 2013, the last count that I looked at was 83. So now that has expanded dramatically, right? You don't have to have all those in a delegation wizard trying to assign those permissions in Active Directory. If you try to do that, what would the AD guy say? Stop trying to make Swiss cheese of my Active Directory, right? So it's all managed by Exchange now through the RBAC model. What goes to the back end is completely different. Management role entries are individual commandlets and parameters. So when you lump them all together, it makes the role, and then when you do the assignment, that role is assigned to a given user or group of users. So when we talk about customization, first of all, you have 83 roles built in about that. It might be a little bit more as you get more updates. It might add or remove a couple of them based on relevance. But when you have those roles, sometimes you just want to use them as is because it maps to your job roles. People who are going to use it need all of that. That's predefined. You just take that as is, assign it. But what if you wanted to customize it? How does it work? All of these management roles are defined in Active Directory. So if you go to configuration partition and go to the org object, you will find all the management roles defined in there. If you want to create a custom role, of course, you don't have to go to AD and open the AD as I added, right? That would be lame. But when you create one using Exchange, that definition is again stored there. So what you would see is you would see a folder structure, kind of. You would see a folder structure of all the roles that are predefined. And then if you were to create a new one, the first thing you will have to do is select a parent. So you will select a built-in role that has all the commandlets you need and maybe some more. The idea of customization in sense of Exchange is you pick a role that has everything you need and then remove some. You cannot take a parent, create a child, and then add stuff that wasn't in parent. So if you wanted to create a role that combined, say, help desk and mailbox management or server management, something like that, what you would do is you would create two separate roles coming from two separate parents because all the commandlets you need aren't necessarily in one given management role. And then you would assign both of them to the user who is going to perform the functions because the permissions with RBAC are additive. So when you assign multiple roles, all of that combine, and when you're presented with your user interface in EAC or when you're given the commandlets in the management shell, you get all those commandlets you have access to. So you don't necessarily have to have just one management role that is custom. You can have multiple custom roles based on the definition of the job role. Combine that to give someone access that you may not have in a single parent. So the thing to remember is basically you have a parent-child relationship and you cannot assign more commandlets than the parent had. However, you can create a chain. So you can create from the built-in role, the first custom role, and then you can create yet another custom role from that custom role as a parent. I would personally stay away from doing that because each role that you use as a parent cannot be changed. It has a dependency, right? Now, the parent roles that are built in, you cannot modify them anyway. That's built-in roles. But the custom roles that you defined, you can change them. You can add the commandlets that you had removed earlier if the scope changes. Or you can remove the commandlets that you no longer need for that given job definition. So if you create yet another child from that custom management role that you created, that would not help you when you want to customize that parent again. It's your custom parent role, but it's not going to be customizable anymore from that point on because it has dependency. Just keep that in mind when you model your RBAC permissions. Now, in general, the last bullet is you have to have a parent when you create a role. However, as with everything else in the world, there is always an exception. You always have something that allows you to do something out of norm. We'll talk about that a little bit later. What your roles allow you to do, the built-in roles or the custom roles that you built based on the built-in roles as a parent, is you have the default scopes assigned to them. Scope is where you can perform your functions, in a particular OU or on particular servers, or create the mailboxes on a particular database. Those are your scopes. When you create a child, when you create that custom role, it either inherits, if you don't define the scope, it inherits the default scope. For the built-in commandlets, built-in management roles, that scope is org-wide. So if you are not careful, if you do not define the scope when you're creating the new role, you're basically giving that management role access to everything in the org. So you can change that. Now if we talk about that exception, the exception is called unscoped top level. And that's exactly what it is, unscoped. It has no scoping, which means it applies to everything in the org. You cannot limit it to a particular server or a particular OU for users. It's unscoped. And it's top level. Now, up until now, we were talking about parents, the built-in roles being the top level. This one doesn't become a child of any of them. The unscoped top level is sitting at the same level as those built-in roles. However, it's your role, the custom one that you created. No scope, no parent, and no commandlets, because there is no parent. You did not select any parent. It has no commandlets whatsoever assigned to it. You're basically creating an empty container. Once you create that empty container, you can decide what to add as a commandlet into it. You can either create a script that someone is going to run, put it in as a commandlet that they have access to remotely. You can add commandlets from Exchange, which you could do with the regular roles anyway, with the parent-child relationship we talked about. Or you could assign them additional commandlets from the modules that you have, the PowerShell modules you have installed on the server that allows them to do server management, for an example. So that's the power of unscoped top level. It not only allows you access to the commandlets you have within Exchange, it allows you to create those custom scripts, assign those scripts to the user. So think of it as a business process. If you have a business process that defines you must create mailboxes in a certain way, they must be stored on a certain mailbox when they're provisioned the first time. They must have certain parameters defined, minimum, maximum, quota, your warning levels, any other permissions, anything that you have to do with it, right? If you create a script that basically follows that logic, the business logic that you have to have, there are two ways you can use that script. You can take that script, give it to your help desk or admins who are going to be responsible for doing that job function, and let them run with it. Now, when they have that script, they won't be able to run that script until you actually give them permissions on RBAC. You add them to some existing management roles or assign them custom management roles. So not only you have a script that you give them, you also have to give them permissions in RBAC. With unscoped top level, what you can do is you can assign that script to them as a part of the role. You don't have to assign them individual commandlet access, which means the script could be creating new mailboxes, but you don't have to give them access to new mailbox commandlet itself. You just give them access to the script. And whatever the script does, Exchange will perform in the backend. Right? Very, very powerful. The other difference here is your scripts. When you give the script to a user, if you were that user and if I was to give you the script, what would you do first? Look at the script, right? Just let me see what he's trying to do. And it's a good idea. You don't want to just blindly trust someone's script. But at the same time, as the org management member, you're trying to define a business process that they have to adhere to. You give them the script, chances are they will modify it. They have ability to. They have the script in their hands. They can do whatever they want. They can modify the script. And if they can modify the script, there goes your business logic, right? You don't have that business logic anymore once that script is modified. It's different from your business logic. Now you're not following that scripted path of steps that you have to perform for a given function. With OnScope Top Level, when you assign the script is never handed out to users. The script resides on the server itself. Unless that person has access also to the server, then they can access the script, but otherwise they don't have access to the script. They get access to the script in a way that they can run it, but they cannot look at what's in the script. They see that script as a commandlet in their shell, and I'll show you that that's actually exactly what we're coming up on. So it's going to be a small little demo. Okay. So what we have is, I'm just going to switch to full screen. What we have is a business logic. The business logic is you must create a mailbox with certain UPN suffix. So I'm sure most of you at least know, if you haven't dealt with the deployments where you have multiple domain names coming in the org, and then certain users have one domain name in their email address, certain users have another in their email address. So your UPN suffixes could be different. Your business process says your new mailboxes must have certain UPN suffix. For our example, it's tech@northamericademo.com. You must create it in a certain database. So we have fixed the database in the script. That's where it will create the mailbox. It must create this mailbox in a certain OU, so we are fixing that. We are saying that all these mailboxes are VIP users, so they must reside in the VIP user's OU. You don't want the help desk who is going to create these mailboxes to assign different passwords when they create the mailbox. You want to have a fixed password. It's a process where it would they would be notified when the mailbox is created that this is your mailbox, this is how you access it, this is what your first time password is going to be. It's all fixed, so you fix that in the process. And then the last one is basically you are actually putting it all together and running the script. Right, you're running the new mailbox commandlet, creating that new mailbox in the location that you define. That's the business logic. Now, if you look at the process of assigning that permissions, what I'm going to do is take this script, and we don't need to look at this script line by line. What I'm going to do is just run it in management shell. So when we go here, what we're going to do is call that script. The first thing we want to do is look at the unscoped management role assignment. The unscoped top level, who is it assigned to, and who can run the commandlets to create an unscoped top level role, right? So we are actually just going to run that, and what you would see is you have one. So you have one assignment of that management role. Not two, not three, there is just one. And if you look at the name, I will highlight that so it's easier to see. Only if I can find my mouse. Okay, there we go. What you have is unscoped role management, which allows you to manage unscoped roles. It is assigned to organization management. And if you look at the name, the way they're created by default, the last one is delegating, which means it allows you as a member of organization management to delegate this function to someone, whether it's you or whether it's someone else. What that means, and if you look at this role assignment, what is the role assignment? The role assignment is delegation org-wide. There are two different types of assignments. One is regular, and one is delegating org-wide. Regular is you have permission to perform the functions defined in this role. Delegating org wide means you do not have permission to run these functions defined in this role. However, you have permission to assign that to someone else. So as an org management, you still don't have access to create top level roles. Think of that as a protection mechanism. Because it is so powerful, but at the same time so dangerous, it has destructive powers. You could create a script on scope top level, someone has access to that. That could be very good or very bad, depending on what the script is doing, or whatever other commandlets you're assigning them to. So let's try to assign on scope top level permissions for help desk by creating a new role. What we're going to do is create a new management role, help desk provisioning script, and we are going to make it on scope top level, right? We try to do that, you get an error. Like I said, as an admin, you don't have permissions to create those on scope top level roles. You only have permission to assign that permission to someone else, whether it's yourself or someone else. Built in, just like mailbox import and export, which out of box no one has access to. Why? Because if anybody from org management by default, let's say, has access to import-export mailboxes, now they have ability to see what's in those mailboxes, and that could be a problem depending on industry you were in. So what we are going to do now is, as an org management, we are going to delegate ability to create on-scope top-level roles to ourselves. So that's that commandlet right there, new management role assignment. We are giving ourselves permissions, and now we have that. If we go back and run that new management role again, which is exactly what we are going to do next, is when we run that again, now you will be able to create that new role you wanted to. Okay. Yes, this is expected. I'm sorry. The reason this error is expected is we just assigned ourselves permissions. When are they evaluated? When you start the management shell. When you open management shell, it goes through your permissions and it brings in those commandlets, right? When we started this shell, it did not bring in the on-scope top-level parameter for us. And even if we assign that permission, it's not going to be effective until we start another management shell. So let's go ahead and do that. Okay. So while we are waiting for that, I could just go ahead and copy that. Go to the new one that's starting, and this is where you will see it retrieving the commandlets you have access to up top, right? Creating roles, bringing your commandlets in. And now you will be able to run that commandlet that was giving you an error before, right? So now you were able to create that management role that is basically empty role right now, has nothing in it. So the next step after we created that role is we are going to add a management role entry. Role entry is basically the commandlet. The commandlet in our example is going to be that custom script that you created. So if you look at that command, what we are doing is we are adding a management role entry to that empty container. The commandlet is going to be a PowerShell script. And what we are adding that PowerShell script to is the role that we just created. So let's take that. Again, it's a different window, so we got to make sure we run it in the window we have access to. Okay. And that is another error that's expected. When you run that, Exchange is expecting that the script that you just said it should have access to should be accessible to everyone who are going to run these commandlets remotely. Where should that script be? Where should you copy that script? It has to be copied to a specific location. So let's take that script, copy that, and the location, if I can minimize that, it's just out of bounds. There we go, okay. If you look at the location, where it's at is in Exchange install folder. There is a folder called remote scripts. By default, it's created. It has one script in it, which is console initialized, the one that's used by management shell. You just copy and paste your script right in there. When you do that, now your script is accessible remotely by using that management role that you defined without giving access directly to the script. Again, like I said, permissions are important. Who has keys to the kingdom is important. So if somebody who you are giving access to with this script and the unscoped top level, you don't want them to be able to modify this script. And then you have, by definition, access to the server for that person. All the security that you're trying to put around that script is useless because they can go to the server, access the script, look at what's in there, right? So just separate those functions. As long as you do, then what you're trying to do is achievable. Otherwise, it's no point. Going back to this, if we run that, you get no errors. The entry is defined. And that's fine. The next one is, what we are doing is we are creating a role group. We just created the role. The role defines what commandlets whoever's going to have access to will be able to run. But we haven't defined who has access to this yet. And that's really the next step. What we are doing is we are creating a group in which we will be able to then put users, administrators, help desk users in. So we run that, actually, so I go back, sorry. One too many windows. So we take that. Run it in the window where you have access. Now we just created that group. If you go to Active Directory, this group shows up there. It's a universal security group that you just created. And now you add a user who will have access to this script that you just created, the role that you just created. So let's go ahead and take that last step. The user is called helpdesk1 in this example. So what we are going to do next is log on as this user and see what access they have. So let's just make sure this is the end of the run. So this last one I'm going to hold off for now. What we'll do now is I'll switch to a remote machine. I certainly don't want to run it from the server itself as a help desk user, right? The idea is that user does not have access to the server itself. So, unlock, bring it over, and go full screen. What we're going to see here is, this is my, actually, I might have logged on as a wrong user. Correct user. Sorry, didn't mean to keep you in suspense. Okay, and what I have is those two commands that I showed you how to connect remotely. I just dumped it into a PowerShell script so it's easier for us. We don't have to type all that, connect to the server. What we are going to do is, as a help desk user, we are going to connect. It connects, it brings in the commandlets you have access to. And what do you see as exported commands? That's that last column in the table. As an admin, if you have done this before, you would notice you would have a lot of things with three dots at the end because it cannot show you everything you have access to. In this example, this help desk user doesn't even have a mailbox. And since you don't have a mailbox, you don't have any command list that you can access, any command list whatsoever. So the only command that they have access to, if you notice, is that script that we created and assigned that user access to. So that's really all that user can do. If we go ahead and now call the new custom mailbox name, that's really all there is to the script. We defined it on purpose to make it simple. Has the business logic in the back end. The person who's performing the function doesn't need to know a lot about that business logic. And there you have it. You have the mailbox. You have the mailbox created based on your business logic. And the way we can verify it is simply go to our Exchange server. So here's our Exchange server. Sorry, I don't think it's the right window. Yeah. Okay, so if we switch over to this one, by default, out of the box install, it only had administrator mailbox. It didn't have anything else, and we just created that other mailbox. So when you refresh this, you would notice that mailbox was created. If you go to the properties, you would notice it was created based on your logic in the database that you wanted with the password that you defined. And what did user have access to? Nothing but that script itself. They cannot see the commandlet, new mailbox. They cannot use any of the parameters. They cannot mess anything up. Right, so that's the power of Unscope top level. Let me switch back to our presentation and keep going. All right, so let's look at next set of components. And before we do, let me just quickly point out what we just went through was this portion, right? We assigned the parameters, we assigned the command lines, we created a management role. That's what we talked about. But in demo, we actually covered this component, and this component, right? However, because it was unscoped top level, we did not do anything in terms of scope. It's unscoped. It has access to everything. How did you limit that? You limit that with the logic in the script. With the script, you defined it has to be created on this database. Now you just scoped it to that database, right? It has to be created in exactly this OU. Now you scoped it to that OU. You controlled that logic from the script that you created. So it's unscoped top level. However, you did touch all these different components, along with the very important one, the role assignment, where you assigned that role you created to the users. You married that to critical functions, so user has access to that and they can run it. All right, so the next one is where. We talked about basically the commandlets and the what function. Right, the where function is the location where you're allowing them to perform the function. The location could be OU, server, database. We talked about all that. What Exchange gives you in that sense is you can simply define the OU when you're creating a scope. So when you use the new management scope, when you create that, you have the parameters that allows you to define the OU straight away. You could use the server list to restrict the scope to a given set of servers. That usually applies only to the configuration, because the server list is used for configuration, not necessarily for users. Recipient root is the OU we talked about. What if you want to do something more creative? Let's say you want to limit the scope not to one OU, but multiple OUs. However, you don't, they those multiple OUs don't necessarily exist as a hierarchy from the parent to the child. They are distributed across your Active Directory. They might be in the same level as the other OU. So when you use the OU scope, that is limited to one given OU, right? Not multiple OUs. You could, if you want to do that multiple OUs for an example, you could use the OPATH filters to define different OUs with the dash AND. You could use the AND operator. You could use different OPATH filters that are allowed to be used. Now, how many of you actually transitioned to OPATH filters when you went to 2007? So you know what the OPATH filters are. And if you don't, that's okay. There is a very good article that translates your AD attributes to the OPATH filter attributes that Exchange uses. So when you look at that, you will know which filters you can use, which then opens up the possibilities of what you can do to create the scope. Now, there is one scope. So in general, when you have scope, scope defines where you can perform a function. You can assign multiple roles to users, to the admins, and that allows them to perform functions in multiple scopes, because one role may have scope one, the other one may have scope two, based on different functions, if it's config, if it's recipient scope. When you have those multiple scopes, they combine, right? They overlap, if you think of that overlapping figures. However, if you want to define a scope where there is no inheritance, something similar to the concept in AD, right? In Active Directory, you have the GPOs that can be inherited down from the top level into other OUs. How many of you actually touched AD and went into one of the OUs where your servers were to stop inheritance from the OUs, from the GPOs that were coming from top down and causing issues with your Exchange servers? If you had to do that, you know what it means, right? You want to be exclusive. You want the inheritance to be blocked. In terms of scope, when you create an exclusive scope, what that means is as soon as you create an exclusive scope, you just locked everyone out in terms of administration, including yourself as an org management admin. The top-level admins are locked out as well. And that's the whole purpose of exclusive. You do not have any implicit permissions. You have to explicitly assign who has permissions to that scope. And that's very powerful, because if you want to control who has access to certain things that are very important, very critical, whether it's configuration of the server parameters, whether it is exclusive objects like VIP users, the pain and the pleasure of our existence, right? When you want to manage them, without the possibilities of inheritance and crossover from the other scopes, you create an exclusive scope. Now, like I said, the first thing that happens when you create an exclusive scope is you lock everyone out. So what do you do? The first thing you do after that is add someone in there who is going to have access. And you can do that because you have that delegating permissions, the permissions that allow you to delegate permissions to someone else. Okay, the next one is who, and the who, I actually want to go to this one to illustrate. Okay, good. In who, there are two separate silos. One is administrators, which is where you assign permissions of running the commandlets, and you assign them permissions of where they can run those commandlets. However, when you're a user, you're able to go to ECP. You're able to manage your own parameters. You know, you change your phone number, change your address, change your out of office. When you're doing all that as a user, do you really need access to any other scope? Like, do you need to reach other objects You don't. You're a user. You're only managing your own object. So in terms of scope, the scope is always self. You're only managing yourself, right? And the difference between when you assign something to administrators and when you assign something to users is in administration, you can assign multiple management roles to do different functions. In user's case, you can assign them only one policy, one assignment policy. So out of box, there is a default policy that allows them to do certain things. If you have never changed that, all the stuff that you can do from ECP is by default assigned to them. You can certainly take that away and create your own policy, which is more restrictive or more flexible for users, and then assign that to the users. But you can have only one policy assigned at any given time to any given user. Going back a couple slides, so then we talk about who. That's basically a direct assignment to user. If it's a user scope, it's the policy that we talked about. Or for administrators, it's multiple management roles that you created and add them to the groups. When you created the management role, as we were talking through that, you noticed we created a role group. A group can have multiple assignments. So a group can have multiple management roles assigned to it. And the best example is org management. You are an org management user. You add yourself only into org management group in AD. And you get access to everything, right? That everything is because multiple roles are assigned to it. All the role groups, by default, if you didn't move anything, is in the root domain, if you have the hierarchy of parent domain and child domain and such. In the root domain, an OU is created when you install Exchange. The Exchange Security Groups OU exists there. When you create the new role groups, that's where the role group is created. So when we created that new role group for the help desk, it's created in this OU, in the root domain. All the role group commandlets allow you to create the new role group, manage the membership, add and remove members and such, without ever leaving your Exchange server, trying to go hunt down an AD administrator to do that for you. You don't have to call an AD administrator and say, hey, can you add this guy to that role group that I just created? You don't have to. Now, how many of you had either your AD admins or you have some AD admin that came up to you and said, I don't like this stuff in root. I want to move it to certain domain in certain OU. Did you have a question where they said, all this stuff that Exchange created, I don't want it here. I want to move it somewhere else. And you had to find out whether you can move it or not. Very few. But yeah, there are orgs that are more oriented to organize things, put it in certain place. It doesn't have to litter my AD. And that's okay. If you want to do that, you can move that OU we talked about that's created to a different domain in the same forest. When you move that OU, when you drag and drop that OU in the AD users and computers, what happens is the other well-known objects attribute of your Exchange org object is automatically updated to point to the new location of that OU. And that means you should not move the groups inside it partially to a different OU, right? That's that second bullet. Basically, you can move the whole OU somewhere else, or you can just take all the groups in it and move it somewhere else, all of them. But do not try to move some of the groups. So the idea is, when Exchange was installed and this OU was created, it had these objects that were built in. So let me leave that where it is and take the custom groups that I have created and move it where I want to. Please don't do that. When you do that, it's the recipe for disaster. So would it work? It probably would. It would have some unexpected results. And if that is, and if you call Microsoft, they would probably spend 3 days figuring out what's going on. And then they will say, well, why did you move only some of the groups and not all of them? So be cognizant of that. Don't move only some of them. Either move, the best thing is if you really want to move it, move the whole OU, or move all of the groups that are in it. Role assignment. So we define those three things, your scope, your commandlets and parameters. You define the users who are going to perform that functions. All of these on its own has no access. When you created the management role and when you created those users and scopes, that doesn't mean anything until you actually create the assignment that ties them together, right? Depending on which commandlet you run, it sometimes happens automatically, like when we did. When we created that role group and assigned it the management role, it created the assignment automatically. We didn't have to run the new management role assignment. But you could, for the existing roles and new groups that you created, you can just take that and assign them using this commandlet. So the two things that are required when you define the management role assignment is users who are going to run that, which is the role group, and the role which defines the commandlets. You don't have to define the scope. Sorry. You don't have to define the scope, but if you don't define the scope, it will inherit the scope from the parent, the role that you have defined, the role that you selected in here. If you define the scope, now you created that assignment that restricts you to certain location. Okay. So the next one, we are going to demo how to create a custom RBAC role. Now, we created the unscoped top level. It's the similar process, however, it's a little bit more involved. Not that one. That one. Okay. Okay. Coming back to those steps that we were running continues in the demo that we are going to do now. The first one we are going to do is we are trying to assign the mailbox import-export. I suppose we can skip this one, but the idea behind this one is what we expect here is a failure. The reason is similar to the unscoped top level. By default, you don't have access to import-export mailbox commandlets and role. However, I guess I'm missing something in the script. Give me just one sec. Okay, so that's not part of the script. What we want to do is we want to create custom RBAC role. The steps are going to be you will have to pick a parent, and then you will have to define your own. So let's do that by looking at. A role. So these are all the built-in roles, quite a few. What we are going to do is we are going to take one of them. I guess we could just take mail recipients or mail recipient creation. Most common function, right? You're creating new mailboxes. So what you're going to do is create a new management role. You, of course, have to give it a name that is, let's say, something like custom mail recipient creation. And then, as we had discussed before, you have to define a parent. Without parent, you can't create a custom role unless it is unscoped one. So that's our parent. And that's really all you need to create a child. You are not modifying it just yet. You are just creating it. Creation. it actually is a little bit picky about what it uses as identity. So if you're using a wrong one, it's just going to give you that error. You use the parent, it creates the new role. It's basically an exact copy of the parent at this point. You haven't modified anything yet. Now, if you do get management role entry, for the one that we just created, yeah, identity would be fine. Sorry, mouse is a little bit touchy. Okay, so the one that we just created, we're going to take that. And what we are saying is, show me all the management role entries in this role. And these are all the commandlets that are in there, in the role that we just copied. Now, let's take an example of the commandlet that we want to remove. We don't want someone to be able to run any of these remove commandlets. We want them to be able to create new mailboxes, but not remove, right? So what we would have to do here is say remove star, and it should show us only the remove commandlets. And then we can just take that and pipe it into remove management role entry from the role that we wanted. Right? We don't have to define which ones because we are piping it from the previous commandlets. We just said, get me all the remove commandlets and remove it from this role entry, from this management role entry that we just created. And this is that funny part I was mentioning. It's finicky about exactly which name it wants to use. So now we're going to have to find the identity that it... no, that's role type. For each is right, but for each... I don't think is the issue here because the commandlet we are using accepts the parameters from pipeline. I'm just trying to find the identity. So let's just do the identity first. Get management role. Right, yes. Fun stuff of FL, right? FL star. Show me the identity. That is the identity. Okay, what we are going to do, I believe I know what the problem is. Okay. That's not it, sorry. Let's try it that way. Okay, no error is good. It's asking me, should I remove all of this? I can say all. And you know, all doesn't mean all, right? Oh, sorry. L. And if we go back to the role now, we just removed all those remove entries from that role that we created. So now when we look at that custom role again, sorry, slash star, you would notice there are no more remove commandlets in there. That's at its simplest what you can do with this customization of the roles, right? So that's left probably because of the filter was wrong, the filter that we used. If you really want to remove that, you can either, again, run the proper filter that catches that entry, or just type that particular entry and remove it too. Either way, the purpose, I guess, of the demo is served in the interest of time. Couple things. Watch out for, we talked about removing the commandlets. Don't remove, so sometimes you get overzealous and you try to remove all the stuff you think is not necessary. View AD server settings is one of the commandlets you should not remove. If you remove that, what's going to happen is when you launch the admin center, it relies on looking at all the objects, pulling all the objects to show you the ones that are relevant and are your objects. When you move the OUs, so if you have created custom scopes, you have the scope that's looking at certain OU. If you move that OU somewhere else, those RBAC roles and scopes will not be updated automatically. So make sure you go back and update those scopes. Okay. We're a little bit over time. I see other people starting to roll up. Let me go over one more thing here and then we'll end. Behind the scenes, how does this all run? We talked about it earlier, actually, a little bit. But if you dig down into it, Exchange Server, when you install it, it creates Exchange Trusted Subsystem. You would have noticed that group somewhere in the Active Directory. What it does is it puts Exchange Servers in it, and it assigns that object permissions on Active Directory to do everything Exchange should be able to do. So when you run the commandlets in Exchange, RBAC looks at those commandlets only to see if you have permission to run those commandlets. Once it does, it then uses Exchange Trusted Subsystem to run those commandlets and modify the objects in AD. So when you look at AD for auditing, you're not going to see the user who ran those commandlets. You're going to see Exchange Trusted Subsystem performing those functions. And that's something to keep in mind, because all those auditing happens in the Exchange now. The reliance on AD has been removed, and the benefit is you don't have to go to AD guys to see who did what. On the flip side, AD guys would never know who did what. They would only see Exchange doing all the functions in Active Directory. You, on the other hand, will be able to run the auditing commandlets that you have built in to figure out who did what when. And with that, I'm sorry, we ran over a few things. You will have access to the slide deck. In Link, there are a few things different. I will run through it very quickly. And that is, in Exchange, when you customize something, you can remove the parameter level entries, not only the commandlets, but you can also remove the parameters. So you can leave the commandlet accessible to someone, but certain parameters are not accessible, as we saw in the unscoped top level. We were able to create management roles, but we weren't able to create unscoped top levels because you didn't have access to that parameter. In Link, you don't have that granularity. You can add and remove commandlets. You cannot remove the parameters. The other difference in Link is when you create a role, you are using a parent, but you are not tied to the parent like you are in Exchange. So you can add other commandlets in the custom role you created, the commandlets that you did not have in the parent role. So that's the difference between Exchange and Link. The rest of the idea behind the RBAC functionality is same. With that, I'm sorry, a couple of slides didn't get covered, but you will have access to that. The gist of it is covered. I'll take the questions, and I'll take it offline, actually.